Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
My name is Jack Citrin. I am presently the director of the Institute of Governmental Studies here at UC Berkeley. And on behalf of the Institute and also on behalf of Dean Chris Edley and the Berkeley School of Law, who is co-sponsoring this event with IGS. I welcome you to this conference entitled The American Presidency at War. I think that anyone who's looked at the program will immediately recognize that we have a truly distinguished set of panelists and participants, and I think it will be a truly stimulating day. I want to thank Terry Bimes, the Department of Political Science, and John Yu of the Law School for really doing the work of convincing our speakers to come to this, you know, remote outpost on the fringe of the United States where the weather and food is not reliable, but thank you for coming. With those comments made, I want to turn the floor over to the first panel and the chair of the first panel, Terry Bimes, my colleague in the Department of Political Science.
Thanks, Jack. Well, it's my privilege to introduce this great panel we have here this morning. First, I'd like to introduce, I'll just go in order. Gary Jacobson will be the discussant for this panel, and he's a professor of political science from UC San Diego. He has many important books, including The Politics of Congressional Elections, which is now in its sixth edition, Money in Congressional Elections, and The Electoral Origins of Divided Government. Most recently, he's the author of A Divider, Not a Uniter, George W. Bush and the American People. Matt Baum will be giving a paper today, and his he just recently moved from UCLA to Harvard, though he's still a UCLA fan, I understand. His research seeks to understand the relationship between media, public opinion, and presidential decision-making. Among other publications, he's the author of Soft News Goes to War, Public Opinion and American Foreign Policy. Then we have Adam Berensky, who's a professor of political science at MIT. His first book was entitled Silent Voices, Public Opinion and Political Participation in American Politics. And his second book is about to be published by, I believe, the University of Chicago. And it's entitled America at War, American Public Opinion During Wartime, from World War II to Iraq. And then last, we have John Mueller, who is the Woody Hayes Chair of National Security Studies at Ohio State University. His most recent book is Overblown, How Politicians and the Terrorism Industry Inflate National Security Threats and Why We Believe Them. One of his many claims to fame is that he appeared on the Jon Stewart Daily Show to discuss his book. So we are happy to have him here after receiving that honor. So why don't we start with Matt, and then Adam, and then John will be the last one to present, and then Gary will give a discuss.
So basically, this is the project that I'm going to talk about a little bit today. I should say that I can't take any credit for this beautiful graphic. My co-author, Tim Groling, is the multimedia expert in our collaboration. As all of you are doubtless well aware, there have been lots of different views over the last number of years regarding what exactly the reality with respect to Iraq really is. And this ranges from back in 2003, where Dick Cheney said, my belief is that we will, in fact, be greeted as liberators, to in 2007, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid saying, in effect, this war is lost and the surge is not accomplishing anything. Democratic candidate Barack Obama, weighing in, offered the following: the tactics of how we ensure our troops are safe as we pull out, how we execute the withdrawal, those are things that are all based on facts and conditions. I am not somebody, unlike George Bush, who is willing to ignore facts on the basis of my preconceived notions. And finally, going back a little bit in history, none other than Thomas Paine in 1776 made the following observation. A long habit of not thinking a thing wrong gives it a superficial appearance of being right and raises at first a formidable outcry in defense of custom. Time makes more converts than reason. So, in essence, the purpose of this project is to investigate the relative effects of time and reason on public attitudes regarding war. So, this brings me to the present study, and just to start with a shameless plug for the book that's attached to this project, this study I'm presenting today is, in fact, part of a larger book, which the publication God Smiling Upon Us will be out about this time next year. But the key questions I want to talk about today are, what are the relative influences of reality and rhetoric in shaping public opinion about military conflict in general, and of course, about Iraq? How do these shift over time, and what difference do people's partisan predispositions make in these attitudes and attitude shifts? And to try and understand this, I want to start by talking a little bit about what we know from the literature on public opinion and the use of force. The literature is fundamentally divided between studies of the short and longer term in this relationship. In the short term, we're really talking about the rally around the flag literature. And here, the idea is basically that rallies, public opinion rallies, that is, when the president sends the nation's troops into harm's way, the public responds by rewarding the president with a spike in his approval ratings, which may be very brief or may last a little while. But the emphasis in explaining the cause of this has been on the tenor of elite debate as determining whether or not the public will rally and how much. So if the public turns on the news and they see bipartisan elite support for the president, in other words, Congress in a bipartisan way rallying around the president, then they'll do that too. If, on the other hand, they see partisan bickering and Republicans and Democrats going at each other about the wisdom of the policy, then they'll fall back into their partisan corners and you won't get much of a rally. So we call this the elite indexing hypothesis, and this is most closely associated with the work of Richard Brody, though lots of people have written about it. In some contrast, longer-term studies, which are basically everything except the rally around the flag literature, tend to emphasize rational public reactions to the characteristics of conflicts themselves, including the principal policy objective, whether the war is offensive or defensive in nature, the number, rate, or trend with respect to casualties, as well as perceptions of whether things are going well or going badly. And what we want to try and do is bridge this divide between our understanding of the short term, the immediate effects, and the longer term, what happens over time. In the short term, we argue that presidents always claim to be acting in self-defense. There's no such thing as an offensive war, in the war of aggression in the short term. Success, in turn, is typically pretty ambiguous, and casualties haven't had time to mount. And even if they have, their implications are often ambiguous. The public, in turn, doesn't know all that much about foreign affairs, and as a consequence, uninformed citizens are disproportionately dependent on information shortcuts, most notably the opinions of elites that they trust in trying to formulate their opinions, and this, after all, is the notion behind the elite indexing hypothesis. In the longer term, in contrast, public perceptions of reality, we would argue, are typically endogenous to the elite competition to frame events to their own advantage. In other words, there is a battle going on to interpret reality. It's not simply given and everybody can agree on the premises of what is actually happening. And the implication that's most important for our purposes is that elite cues, information shortcuts, are going to matter both in the short and in the longer term, with this divide between relying on information shortcuts in the short term and sort of rational calculations about events in the longer term is a little bit of an artifact, we would argue. Now, to try and bring all this together and tell a coherent story, we sort of came up with this model. And, you know, what I've said so far is static, but we're clearly operating in a dynamic context. Public attitudes about a war unfold over time and respond to what happened before. So this graph represents an attempt to incorporate temporal dynamics into predicting public opinion effects. So the blue curve here represents the influence of elite rhetoric on public opinion over time. And on the vertical axis, you're looking at the amount of influence, basically, on public opinion. So the higher are you up, the more public opinion is influenced. And then the horizontal axis represents time. So as you move from left to right, I guess, from your perspective, you're going out farther and farther in time. The green curve, in turn, represents the influence of events on the ground, or reality, also over time. So the graph shows that in the relatively early stages of a crisis, which we're sort of arbitrarily defining as the time between t time 0 and time 2 on the horizontal axis there, rhetoric tends to trump reality. It has a greater influence. And I should point out that we refer to the time between T0 and T1 here, the short term. This is what we're thinking of when we talk about the rally period, the period where you would observe the rally around the flag effect. So we refer to this gap between the rhetoric and the reality curves as the elasticity of reality. And what that means is the extent to which elites can frame events in a way that is somehow distinct from what is actually happening, the actual tenor of those events. The extent to which elites can spin reality or depart from it and expect the public to accept their declarations. So note that at time T1 here, the elasticity of reality is given by the distance between R1 and C1 on the y-axis. It's pretty big. If you go farther toward the origin, toward the y-axis, it actually gets bigger. Over time, as more information becomes available, the independent effect of elite rhetoric recedes, while the effect of actual events, that is, reality, ought to rise for a variety of reasons, some of which I'll talk about. And through this process, the elasticity of reality narrows. What that means is that elites, over time, have less freedom to frame events independent from what's actually going on. Eventually, the two things meet. And after this, at least for a while, we expect that reality ought to matter more than rhetoric. Why is this? Well, because journalists are gathering more information, citizens are exposed to more information, they can use that to retrospectively assess what they've been told before and what they've observed before, and so the effect of rhetoric relative to reality ought to recede, at least for a while. Now, over the long run, once the public judgment about an event is relatively firmly entrenched, we expect that neither rhetoric nor reality is likely to matter very much. It just becomes increasingly difficult to change the public judgment once it's relatively entrenched. After that point, only a pretty major and pretty sustained change in the tenor of events ought to be enough to shake this public judgment. And as we'll see, and as I'll talk about, the so-called surge in U.S. troops that began in February-March of 2007 does appear to have been such an event, and I'll show you some evidence of that later on. Now, what I've talked about so far is just a uniform present representation of public opinion, but as I said at the outset, we want to think of public opinion not as uniform, but as different groups of people responding differently to informational cues, and one of the most salient differences is partisanship. So what you see on the screen right now is a representation of what we would expect the reaction of different partisan groups to be to a president's attempt to persuade them that things are going really well, that we're doing really well. And this is a scenario in which things are, in fact, going really badly. And so what you see is, over time, the president's fellow partisans really want to believe their fellow partisan president. So they hang on a long time before they start to defect and say, well, maybe things aren't going as well as we thought. Conversely, the opposition party, NPP for non-presidential party, jumps off the ship like, you know, rats leaving a sinking ship at the first sign that anything's going wrong. And conversely, with independents lying somewhere in between. Conversely, if things are going wonderfully, so that the president's telling them things are going wonderfully, and in fact they are, the president's fellow partisans, presidential party partisans, are going to very quickly say, yes, you were right all along, and jump right back up to their prior high levels of support. Conversely, opposition partisans, non-presidential party partisans, are going to be much more slow and cautious in reassessing upward, with, again, independents somewhere in between. So throwing all these assumptions together, we end up with a series of hypotheses. The first, which we call the longer-term communications effects prediction, is that elite rhetoric regarding wars is going to influence public opinion, public attitudes, independent of actual events or reality well beyond the rally period. But absent a major change in the tenor of events, the marginal effect of this rhetoric is going to recede over time. It's not going to be constant. Now, if things do change a lot, this is the corollary prediction we make. If there's a major change, then the public's going to be more susceptible to influence by elite rhetoric in the media relative to reality than would otherwise be the case. And this is going to be especially true if things are going well for the president's fellow partisans and if things are going badly for opposition partisans. Over the long term, the corresponding prediction is that absent a major change in events, the marginal influence of indicators of the war's progress on public opinion are going to increase and then eventually decrease again, sort of in a normal distribution, more or less. However, if things do change in a major way, then you would expect the public to once again become more susceptible eventually to media coverage of reality than they otherwise would be. And the same sort of caveat holds that this is going to be, if things change in a positive way, most true for the president's fellow partisans, in a negative way, most true for opposition partisans. And then we, in the rhetoric versus reality prediction, we expect the marginal influence of rhetoric to fall more and more fast than the marginal influence of the indicators of the war's progress, of reality. And finally, and this sort of throws together those partisan caveats I was adding, after the rally period, if things are going badly, in other words, events are going poorly, then you would expect, or if elite rhetoric is increasingly critical, you would expect that the opposition party, non-presidential partisans, will respond quickly and more than the president's fellow partisans, and the converse if things are going positively, if either events are improving or rhetoric is becoming more positive, with independents falling somewhere in between. So those are the predictions we want to test. And to do this, the quandary we have is that there is no one test that we were able to conceive to test all of this, but we did derive some predictions that, and implications that we're going to try and test through four different analyses. The first is based on a partisan breakdown of opinion in a survey, a national survey we conducted last December with the assistance of Polymetrics. The second is an analysis of partisan breakdown in opinion from a series of Pew Center polls. The third is looking at the effects of reporting of casualties in the news, and here we're looking at New York Times coverage, the valence and the volume, as well as in reality, looking at actual military and civilian casualty figures, the effects of those things on public war support, and for public war support to measure that, we're totally dependent on data that Gary Jacobson was kind enough to provide. Tim and I have sometimes joked that we ought to have made him a third author in this project. Well, I'm not sure he'd want to be, but because we're so dependent on the public opinion data he's farmed out to us over the last few years. And finally, we look at the effect of presidential speeches on the volume of television and print coverage and on partisan war support over time. Now, I don't have time to talk about the methodology here, so I'm going to ask you to just trust me that it's all perfect. And for those of you that really want to, the details are in the text, which I understand is available to everybody, so it makes me feel a little less bad about it. So I'm going to begin with the Polymetrics survey. This went into the field in early December of 2007, which was a uniquely opportune moment for our purposes. It was about 9 months after the surge was announced, and it was fairly shortly after the contentious testimony by General Petraeus before Congress. Elite rhetoric at the time was still quite polarized, as we talk about in greater detail in other parts of the book. But the survey took place a few months, actually about 4 months, after the start of a clear and sustained drop in U.S. military and Iraqi civilian casualties. So I want to begin by testing the two event shift corollary hypotheses, 1A and 2A, that I introduced before, that predict that following a positive shift in events, members of the president's party will quickly seize on the changing reality, while the opposition party, the non-presidential party, and to a lesser degree independents, will cue off of rhetoric consistent with the more negative prior state of affairs. So these two charts examine how Americans observe the prospects for victory in Iraq, as well as the surge's role in decreasing or increasing those prospects. And here these results are broken out by party. So the slide on the left focuses on general perceptions regarding the trend in the prospect of victory in Iraq, while the slide on the right focuses on the perceived role of the surge on that prospect for victory. So consistent with the event shift communication prediction, H hypothesis 1A, Republicans differed sharply from Democrats and independents, believing the prospect for victory had improved considerably over the prior year and appearing to credit the surge for at least some of that improvement. Consistent with H2A, which is the event shift reality effects prediction, Democrats and independents believed that things in Iraq had actually gotten worse over the prior year and that the surge had essentially no effect on the prospects for victory. And it's easy on these slides to see a better, worse, or no change because the zero line, the thick horizontal line represents zero change. So it's if it's above it, that means more. If it's below it, that means less. And if it's right near the line, that implies no change. So next, we examine a question with a more objective answer, whether monthly, average monthly U.S. military and Iraqi civilian casualties had dropped since the start of the surge. So consistent with the first prediction, Republicans overwhelmingly and correctly recognized that there had, in fact, been a drop in casualties. Consistent with the second prediction, however, Democrats and independents were more attentive to elite rhetoric and argued that the situation had basically not changed. The Democrats and independents are right on the zero point there. And finally, the lower right graph tests our first prediction, the longer-term communication effects hypothesis, which predicts decreased marginal effects of rhetoric over time, as well as the partisan long-term effects prediction, which predicts the weakest effects among the president's fellow partisans. And the results show that consistent with the first prediction, Democrats and independents see a decreased influence of the Bush administration since the start of the war, while consistent with the second prediction, Republicans basically see no change over time. Now, obviously, while the partisan differences in the Polymetrics poll are suggestive, they are a single-shot, sort of snapshot perspective, so they don't allow us to trace these differences effectively over time. So to get a better handle on these changes, next we're going to turn to some Pew Center polls on Iraq. And these data allow us to see how partisans perceive progress in Iraq between February of 2007, around the start of the surge, to February 2008, over 6 months after casualties first started declining. So the survey specifically asked respondents whether they perceived progress in Iraq with respect to preventing a civil war on the one hand, as well as with respect to defeating the insurgency on the other. And the initial partisan views here are pretty intuitive. Republicans see more progress than Democrats or independents. The key test of hypothesis 1A, the longer-term communication effects prediction, is the change between February and September of 2007. And here we see, consistent with that prediction, that Republicans show huge jumps in the percent perceiving progress in preventing a civil war and defeating the insurgents, while Democrats and independents are basically flat, or actually, in the case of Democrats in defeating the insurgents in your right-hand chart, they actually see things as having gotten worse, deteriorating over that period. By February of 2008, as rhetoric has more broadly and uniformly shifted, all groups see the situation in Iraq as improving, and this is consistent with the event shift reality effects prediction. Okay. Now we want to look at the changes in public war support as actual casualties on the ground, as well as New York Times coverage of casualties, vary between 2003 and 2007. And basically, what this chart is saying is showing the effects if casualties drop by two standard deviations or if New York Times coverage becomes more positive by two standard deviations, what effect does that have on public war support? And each one of those dots represents the answer to that particular question at a given point in time. The blue curve in this chart examines the impact of the valenced New York Times coverage of casualties on war support. The red line examines changes in war support associated with actual monthly changes in casualties. So note here the big circles, the big thick circles denote statistically significant effects, where changes in casualties or changes in coverage have a significant effect on war support. And the shaded areas indicate places where the two curves are statistically significantly different from each other. So beginning with the rhetoric curve, prior to the surge, we see that consistent with our first hypothesis, the longer-term communication effects prediction, the effects of rhetoric decline absolutely over time. Consistent with our third hypothesis, the rhetoric versus reality prediction in turn, reality subsequently becomes more influential than rhetoric. And both of these patterns are statistically significant, as shown by the thick circles, and significantly distinct from each other, as shown by the shaded regions. It's also worth noting that the reality curve fits very well with the predictions of the longer-term reality effects hypothesis, which anticipated that over time, absent a major and sustained change in the tenor of events, the marginal influence of objective indicators of the war's progress would first increase and then later trail off. Finally, or next, I should say, the tip-up in rhetoric at the end, which is not quite significant, is nonetheless mostly broadly consistent with the event shift communications prediction, which anticipates that following a major change and sustained change in events, the public's going to become more susceptible to influence by elite rhetoric in the media relative to reality than they otherwise would be. In other words, it predicts something of a reset in the curve. And if you look at the far right end of the curve, it looks like a miniature version of the far left end of the curve, which is more or less what we anticipated. And it's also worth noting that at the very end of the curve, in October-November 2007, the effects of rhetoric are again statistically significantly distinct from the effects of reality. So to relate this back to the abstract model I showed you earlier, note that the early, middle, and late patterns here are precisely what the theoretical model anticipated. And to make that more clear, I'm stripping away the details to show just the basic patterns. So the first, early on, rhetoric ought, according to our theory, matter more than reality, and it does. Second, over time, the effects of rhetoric should decline, while those of reality ought to increase, which, again, it does, until reality ultimately becomes more influential than rhetoric, which, again, is what we observe. Third, eventually, the effects of both rhetoric and reality ought to fade as the public judgment becomes entrenched. And again, this is what we observe in the data. And lastly, given a substantial sustained change in the tenor of events, we expect to see something of a reset in the relationships predicted by the model. And we do see some of evidence of this at the very tail end of our series, which unfortunately ended a little bit too early, probably, to observe its full effect. Now, this final graph shows the valence and magnitude of the effects on public war support of presidential statements on Iraq. And these are statements by President George W. Bush that were more than 50% focused on some aspect of the Iraq conflict. And here we're looking over time broken out by party. And the three curves support the longer-term communication effects hypothesis, which predicts that the marginal effects of rhetoric will decrease over time. You can see they do, in fact, decrease over time for all three groups. And the patterns of differential partisan effects across parties, rather, support the partisan long-term effects prediction, which anticipates that given a Republican president, we would expect to see the sharpest declines among Democrats and the shallowest among Republicans. And again, that's exactly what we see here. So just to sum up very quickly, in the first half of our series, reason, or elite rhetoric, predicts changes in war support more than time, or reality, for both Republicans and independents, whereas in the second half of the series, the pattern reverses, with reality, or time, if you will, better predicting changes in war support for Republicans and independents than for Democrats. Now, this, we think, has some positive and negative implications. So just to sum up very quickly, the good news here, I think, is that the elite capacity to frame events, or in doing so, manipulate the public, is not ubiquitous. There are limits, and clearly those limits kick in more and more over time. So that, we think, is good news. You know, we're not selling a story suggesting that elites can't manipulate public opinion, but we are suggesting there are limits to that manipulation. However, there's some potential bad news here, too, I think. First, a perceived, rightly or wrongly, record of manipulation by an administration can prevent the public from recognizing accurately an actual change in reality, even if it occurs. This, if you think of it as sort of like the boy who cried wolf syndrome. And that's, I think, a concern. And lastly, maintaining broad public support for war becomes increasingly difficult in an environment characterized by ever more polarized public opinion and media coverage of foreign policy. And we touch on this a little bit in the presentation that I've given you. You can see pretty stark partisan differences, even more so in other elements of the book. But it's very clear that it's increasingly difficult for presidents to reach beyond their partisan constituencies to build bipartisan support for foreign policy and to sustain that. And I will stop there. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I'm glad to be here today. I'll start my presentation with a story. Let's see if that pops up. Good? Great. The story I want to tell is about a president rallying the nation to a military intervention. And what I have here are some quotes from a Senate debate. So the president, a member of a particular party, has decided that it is important to intervene in a foreign nation. And what I have here is some quotes from a Senate debate that occurred around that time, so sort of the wisdom of intervention. And I have the party A is the party of opposition. Folks who are opposed to the president make the argument that Americans are going to be killed. They're going to come home in body bags, and they'll be killed in a war that Congress has not declared. Second senator says, I'm afraid we might be starting something we can't get out of. I'm afraid we might be there for years and years and years. Party B makes the argument that we do need to intervene. The senator says, well, I know some of my colleagues believe strongly that the administration has not articulated forcefully, consistently, and clearly the missions and goals of this use of force. We cannot let these kinds of atrocities and humanitarian disasters continue if we have it in our power to stop them. I believe that it is our duty to act. And what I'm especially interested in is how the public processes this message. How does the public react to this elite debate? So I have here a poll taken about a month after the debate, and you can see that partisans in the electorate line up with their parties in the Senate. So Party A, the party of opposition to the president, asking, was it the right thing to intervene or not? 46% say it was the right thing. Party B, the party supporting the president, 66% say it's the right thing. So not only do we have a 20% gap, but we're on the other sides of the majority. A majority of the president's partisans say, yes, it's the right thing to do, echoing the Senate debate. And a minority of the out party say that it was the right thing to do. So we have clear divisions both in the Senate and the electorate. Now, this all sounds very familiar, but this is not about Iraq in 2002 and 2003. This is about Kosovo in 1999. And the Party A of opposition is Robert Bennett, Don Nichols, and on the pro side is noted hawk, the late Paul Wellstone. And so the point I want to make here is that party rhetoric is very flexible. And so what I'm going to be talking a little bit about is how these partisan differences translate from the elites, so from party leaders, to the mass public, so how this shapes it. I'm going to be talking a lot of the similar themes to what Matt just talked about. And so this comes out of a project I've been working on, culminating in a book that actually, as of yesterday, has a new title, which is In Time of War. My publisher informed me is the new title. And they're publishing it, so as long as it has my name on the cover, I'm happy. But the central argument of this book is that opinion about war is like opinion about domestic politics. So I'm an Americanist. I study American politics. And what I've tried to do in this book is take the lessons that we know about public opinion, how it's shaped in the domestic realm, to understand how foreign policies are shaped and how the public reacts to these foreign policies. So events can matter, right? Brief, dramatic events, Pearl Harbor, 9/11 come to mind, can shape public opinion directly. But in the book, I argue that contrary to a lot of what scholars, publics, and actually even leaders of foreign countries think, that public opinion during times of crisis is in fact shaped by many of the same attachments and enmities found on the domestic stage. Now, in the book, I look about public opinion from World War II to Iraq, so cover a wide swath of wars. And I'm going to be talking a lot today about Iraq, but I also want to talk a little bit about Vietnam and World War II, kind of as we're moving forward to think about some historical parallels. But again, let me just sort of make the argument briefly is that and it's in the domestic arena, public opinion is primarily structured by the ebb and flow of partisan and group-based political conflict. The kinds of things that you saw in the story that I began my presentation with, thinking about how leaders talk about foreign interventions, how they talk about rallying the American public, and as I showed you in that first story, that often this is very malleable. And what I argue is that citizens understand war and thinking about public opinion about war, the events of war, whether to support a war, by looking at the same sorts of things that they look at when they think about domestic policies. And the most obvious one, the one I'm going to be talking about most today, is partisanship. But in my book, I also look at attachments to particular groups in society. And this is especially important when thinking about World War II at a time when you had very clear ethnic divisions in this country that could be easily mapped onto foreign conflicts. So in thinking about Iraq, it's not quite as important, but World War II at a time that we're fighting countries where lots of folks in this country, their parents had come from just a generation before, adds a new element there. So the argument I'm making basically is that opinion about wars have structure. So there's a long period of time in American politics and political science in general where we thought that maybe people didn't have real opinions, that sort of people were all over the board, and that's not what I'm arguing. But I say that the structure that they have is a fairly simple one. Okay, so I want to start, I'm going to be showing a lot of pictures in this talk. So to kind of give you a reference for the pictures, showing you some analysis here. So this is not my analysis. This is analysis done by John Zoller, who argued that people basically follow their preferred elite. So basically you pick a team and you listen to the messages from that team and you ignore messages from the other team, and that's how you decide opinions. So there's two critical things here. What team do you pick? And the second is, how closely do you pay attention to politics? And what Zoller argued is that what we need to do is think about looking at the people who pay the most attention to their team. Because in that case, if teams have different messages, you're going to see a split in public opinion there. If teams have the same messages, then you're not going to see a split. So the example he uses in foreign policy is the Vietnam War. So I'm showing here at this top panel two pictures about public opinion about the Vietnam War. So on the x-axis here, I have a level of political information, political awareness. Basically, how much attention do you pay to politics? Political science, we know that there's tremendous variation in this. Some people couldn't tell you who the vice president is. Other people can tell you, you know, within a decimal point or two, what the latest in-trade prediction is on the presidential election. And some people are in between, right? So this captures variation in that. And what I have here in 1964 are the differences between what Zoller calls hawks and doves. And Vietnam's a somewhat different case because, remember, the split over Vietnam emerged within the Democratic Party between hawks and doves. So Zoller tries to capture that. And what you can see is in 1964, when everyone's on the same page, both teams have the same message, the more attention you pay to politics, the more likely you are to support war. Right? So the y-axis is support for the Vietnam War. By 1970, after the split emerges between hawks and doves, you see a different sort of pattern. You see that the more attention you pay to politics, the more opposed you are if you're a liberal, a dove, or more supportive you are if you're a conservative or a hawk. And so more to the present point, I want to turn to the first Gulf War. So think about 1990 to 1991. See a similar sort of dynamics. Again, this is Zoller's analysis. Before the congressional election of 1990, there was pretty much a unified debate about what to do with Iraq. So unlike the current Iraq war, where the debate occurred before the congressional election, in this case, pretty much party leaders decided that we were going to have the 1990 congressional election, then we were going to get to the business of discussing war. So before the election, where you have this unified message, basically both parties saying, having the same message, saying it's important to get in there and to deter Hussein from going into Saudi Arabia, kind of keep a status quo, use sanctions and see what happens, you can see that as political awareness increases, support for taking a hard line increases among both Democrats and Republicans. Fast forward a couple months where you have a divergence of messages, where the Republicans basically push and say, we need to go to war now. Democrats push back and say, well, then we need to have a little more time to have sanctions take hold. You see a split. So these are the crucial things to think about. In a case where you have that unified message, where everyone's on the same page, you should see as political awareness levels go up, support for war should go up, regardless of which team you belong to. However, in a case where you have divided messages, that you should see divergence as political awareness goes up. So this is just kind of to give you a feel for what I'm going to show you in a few graphs ahead. So out of this, I developed what I call in my book the elite cue theory, which basically says that, again, citizens take cues from partisan elites, very similar to the story that Matt was telling in the early part of the Iraq War. They say that information matters, however, right? It matters how much attention you pay to politics. Because to use a cue, you need to know where positions of relative actors are. At the same time, these cues can be negative or positive, right? So I use examples. So for my liberal friends in 2000, 2001, all they needed to know was that George Bush thought something was good to say that it was bad. So the proto-example of this, of my mother, who is an Upper West Side New York Democrat, has basically never voted for a Republican in her life, never will. If George Bush says something is good, she said, okay, he says it's good, I know it's bad, and vice versa. Conversely, think about my wife's grandfather, who thought that Bill Clinton was basically one of the seven horsemen of the apocalypse, and anything that he said was a good idea was a bad idea. So if Bill Clinton had said the economy is going well, he said, no, it's not. If he's saying it's going well, it must be going poorly. So the point here is that you don't just need to have positive signals. You don't just have to be a Republican and say, well, I like George Bush. I think what he stands for. You can be a Democrat and think, well, if he likes something, I'm against it. I think what Gary's book has shown very effectively is that this really characterizes the state of affairs after the 2000 election. Right? So one of my favorite quotes from Gary's book is, there was a poll taken after the 2000 election that asked, is George Bush a uniter or a divider? And the quote that gets in the media is that 50% say he's a uniter, 50% say he's a divider. Right. But what's really, you know, sort of as a political scientist, what I like about that is that if you look at Democrats, about 80% said that he was a divider, and among Republicans, 80% said he was a uniter. So basically, you have two people not living in the same political reality, which I'm going to, a point that I'm going to get to in a little bit more. But for the present purposes, what I just want to show you is that you can have that pattern of polarization that I talked about, even in the absence of a vocal opposition, if cue givers give strong and distinct positions. Right, so what I'm going to show you is that this pattern of divergence really characterizes well opinion about Iraq. So this is a survey that hopefully you can sort of see, and that took in 2004 about Iraq. And, well, I guess you can't really see very well, but what you can see is that you have these divided lines. So I asked two measures of war support. Did the U.S. make the right decision to go to war? Is the Iraq war worth fighting? And there's a gap between Democrats and Republicans on this question at all levels of political awareness. But the important thing is that this gap grows as political awareness increases. So sort of saying what you have here is this classic case of people on different teams believing different things. Now, important thing, at the time the survey was taken, the Republicans had a clear message, but the Democrats sort of had a not-so-strong message. So this is August of 2004, so you have Kerry saying, I was for the war before I was against it, maybe, and so there wasn't really a clear position taken there. But partisans in the electorate just needed to know what George Bush thought in order to get a firm opinion there. Now I contrast this with opinion taken around the same time about Afghanistan. What's interesting here is that in Iraq you see that clear pattern of divergence. In Afghanistan, where a case where you have both parties basically saying, yes, it was a good thing to go in there, you see convergence. As information levels increase, support increases for both Democrats and Republicans. But a really interesting thing here is that if you look at all levels of information, Republicans are still more supportive than Democrats, which suggests that, yes, information attentiveness matters, but there really is a basic fundamental gap between the parties on this question. I think looking forward, as Afghanistan becomes more of an issue, it'd be really interesting to see what the dynamics of that look like. So the basic point I want to make here is that partisanship matters, and partisanship continues to matter. And so I'm going to show you next a graph of data that Gary Jacobson has put together, looking at the effect of partisanship on support. So what I've shown you, at one moment in time, Democrats and Republicans differ based on how much attention they pay to politics. But this is true over time as well. Right? So this is support for Iraq war by party. And you can see that really shortly after the war begins, you have a huge gap opening between Democrats and Republicans. It's held fairly large over time. Now, the gap has closed a little bit over the last couple of years, not because the parties have come together, because you see some roll-off among Republican partisans. Right, so this data is I think probably as of Tuesday. Gary's great, you know. So I ask him for the data, and he says, "Well, here's everything. I'm sorry, it's only as of yesterday." So it's great. Yes, it has this great data set. But you can see that Republican support right now is about 70%. Democratic support is about where it's been, just under 20%. So it's only a 50-point gap as opposed to the 60, 65-point gaps that we saw before. And you can talk a little bit about this if folks are interested about why this is occurring among Republicans. So where are we going to be going forward? Well, one question is, you know, as Matt alluded to, the surge that sort of that you see some awareness that maybe things are getting better in Iraq. As you can see this in opinion poll saying, you know, will things be successful? Now, there's some political scientists, Peter Fever and Chris Gelpe, along with Jason Reifler, have made the argument that what matters in determining support for war is how successful the outcome is going to be. So you ask people, do you think things are going to be going better tomorrow than today? Do you think that eventually we will have a successful outcome? And this theory got a lot of play, especially because Peter Fever for a while was working in the Bush administration. So question is, does this determine support for war? Should we see an increase in support for the Iraq war going forward because people from are across the board saying, yes, things are going better? So what I'm going to show you is similar data to what Matt showed you from the Pew data set, but looking over time, really, from the beginning of the Iraq war, do you think that the Iraq war is going well? And what you can see is here again, Democrats and Republicans, there are some common trends that both Democrats and Republicans think it might be going a little bit better. Now, this is only as of about a year ago, but you can see still there's huge gaps here, right? So if at any one moment in time, you know, just like the divider versus uniter question, is the Iraq war going well? You know, if you're a Democrat, I would guess that you would say no. If you're a Republican, I would guess that you would say yes, right? So we still have a tremendous divide here in how people perceive the reality on the ground. And on that survey I showed you earlier about the Iraq war, where I asked about war support, I showed that there's divergence among partisans. You see a similar sort of thing when you ask people how successful the war is going to be. Right, so these first two panels I showed you already, this last panel is a question about perceived success. And really, it depends if you're a Democrat or a Republican, if you think things are going well. And the more attention you pay to politics, you think that maybe there'd be convergence, right? That there's got to be a correct answer to this, that yes, the war is going well, or no, it's not. But you can see, actually, the more attention you pay to politics, the more divergent opinions become on how well the war is going. And this is true not just in 2004, but also 2004 to 2006. So these are those Pew surveys I showed you on that longitudinal graph, shown in four periods in time. And in every case, the more attention people pay to politics, the more divergent their views become. So I want to wrap up with a couple points here, thinking about what things are going to look like as we go forward. Right? So fast forward to 2009, say that Obama wins the election or McCain wins the election, how might trends in war support look different? So let me take for a moment thinking about, let's say Obama wins the election, right? So here'd be a case where Democrats who have opposed the war strongly throughout it have a president who might commit to getting out of Iraq quickly or might say that we need to have sort of a dampening downtime. So this looks a little bit like you might want to think about the after the 1968 election, where Nixon took over control of the presidency and by association control of the Vietnam War. How do Democrats and Republicans respond to a different president, a different leader? So I'm going to show you some of the analysis for the Vietnam, looking at support by levels of political information. Here by partisanship, you can see that through 1968, Democrats and Republicans were pretty much on the same page. But by the time Nixon took over the war in 1970, you see that pattern of divergence. Right? It suggests that having a prominent cue giver shift parties really changes the structure of public opinion. You can also see this in longitudinal data, and I think that this is one of the most interesting graphs for a number of reasons. This is partisan trends in support for the Vietnam War, and taking this data from John's book. But if you look over time, you can see that throughout the Johnson presidency, Democrats were slightly more supportive than Republicans, right? It's about anywhere from about a 4 to, at its height, about 10 percentage point difference. And these differences only look small in comparison to the Iraq war, that really this is sort of what war support differences look over time, and it really, it's an important difference. But what I find especially interesting is what happens after the 1968 election, you can see that these two lines cross, and suddenly Republicans are more supportive than the war than Democrats. Now, admittedly, no one is really happy with the Vietnam War by 1969, but what's interesting is that Republican support basically levels out. It's Democratic support that drops off, right? So if we have a case where Obama takes over and doesn't quickly get out of Iraq, maybe this is what support will look like. But in this case, in the case of Iraq, there's not really much further for Democratic support to drop. You might see a huge drop among Republicans. I say, well, if it's Obama's war, I'm against it. You might see a drop there. But I think that this does have an interesting potent for the future. And I want to close, though, with sort of drawing a lesson from World War II. And this is I mentioned my wife's grandfather. I always like talking about my family members when I give talks because they're you know, sort of all over the place. So this was a column that ran Al Kaiman in the Loop in the summer of 2006. I show it because I'm very proud because up to this point, I think that my wife's grandfather thought that all I did was sit around all day and either teach students or research, and this shows that actually that the research component actually did something, because my research was written up in this column, and this was sparked by a quote by the late Tony Snow on CNN's late edition on June 18th, and it said, if someone had taken a poll on the Battle of the Bulge, I dare say people would have said, wow, my goodness, what are we doing here? But you cannot conduct a war based on polls, and a lot of my friends knew that I was writing a book about World War II and sent me saying, oh, was there a poll conducted? And sure enough, there was a poll conducted. And it didn't say, my goodness, what are we doing here? But I think that there's some interesting dynamics here. So this was taken from December 31st, 1944 to January 4th, 1945. And an interesting thing about and sort of the folk wisdom is that among World War II is that everyone supported it after we went in. And I think by and large this is true. Because the mistake question that we're familiar with today was asked only a couple times during World War II. It was asked in such a way that sort of minimized personal responsibility and that they would ask, in 20 years, do you think other people would think it was a mistake? And so that kind of shows you how great the level of support for World War II was because there was no need to ask a question like that. So the closest thing could find about war support is basically asking, do you support the FDR's policy of unconditional surrender. So asked, if Hitler offered to make peace now and would give up all land he has conquered, should we try to work out a peace or should we go on fighting until the German army is completely defeated? And you can see 73% said we should support unconditional surrender. And what's especially interesting about this is that you don't see the kind of partisan differences that you do today or even in the Vietnam War, that you really had a very small gap. Compare FDR voters to Dewey voters, right? So these are asking people how they voted in the presidential election just 1 month earlier. You can see basically everyone's on the same page. What's especially interesting about this is take the in-party level of support. So the percentage of people who voted for FDR who supported the war, 78%, that's roughly comparable to the folks in the summer of 2006 among Republicans who supported the war, right? So the in-party support, Republicans for Bush, Democrats for FDR, is roughly the same in the two wars, right? But the overall support levels are very, very different because the out party, right, Democrats in the Iraq War, people who voted for Dewey in 1944, here 73% of Dewey supporters supported the war effort. But at the time of the survey in 2006, when Tony Snow made his comment, it was only about 20% of Democrats who supported the war. So thinking, you know, sort of to hearken back to a comment that Matt made, you know, in this time where we have divergence between the parties for perhaps some reasons related to the Iraq War, but really going back to the outcome of the 2000 election, sort of cemented in people's mind their view of political reality for both Democrats and Republicans, could we have a unified level of support? And it'd be an interesting question going forward as we think the outcome of the 2008 election. So thank you very much.
What I'd like to do is deal with some of the issues that the other two speakers have dealt with and try to do a fair amount of comparisons here as well. One of the things that's important to keep in mind, I think, and I'll give you three or four of these sort of bulleted things, is people don't tend to pay very much attention to foreign affairs in general. Or another way of putting it is, what they really want to talk about is domestic issues, and from time to time they're pulled away by international issues, and as soon as the issue goes away, it snaps back. Gabriel Allman once called that the rubber band theory. What I'm going to give you is the percentage of people who choose a foreign policy issue as the most important problem facing the country today, this is the way it was in the 1930s. As you can see, very few people thinking about foreign policy, and even as war was on in 1939, it was only gradually going up. It obviously made a major dent thereafter, and they stopped asking the question during World War II because it was pretty obvious what the most important problem was. But if you look here, right after the war, the percentage of people talking about foreign policy went basically back to zero, practically. And then it was pulled away by various Cold War crises at various places. Really interesting is right after the Cuban Missile Crisis, which obviously arrested attention enormously, there was a drop-off as tensions dropped during the Test Ban Treaty of 1963, and it basically stayed low except for the war in Vietnam. So if you add on that, the effect of the war in Vietnam, as you can see, there's very little additional impact. It's almost all entirely about the war in Vietnam. Also extremely interesting is at the end of the war in Vietnam, which is 1973, which was when the Americans basically backed away, though the war lasted another 2 years, and also when we got John McCain back, the attention to international affairs drops off almost to nothing, and it more or less stayed that way until 9/11. This is the percentage of people saying things, talking about foreign affairs since the 1970s. The Iran crisis, the hostage crisis, and Afghanistan in 1979, nuclear fears of various sorts having to do with Reagan, et cetera, in the early 80s, the Gulf crisis of 1991, and then, of course, 9/11 and the Iraq War. It's still more or less at 25% off and on. The way I tend to look at it is people sort of look at the issue fairly directly and apply a reasonable cost-benefit analysis to it. But, however, there's a bias in their analysis in that they value the lives of Americans very greatly and the lives of foreigners almost not at all. This sort of shows a pattern. This has to do with the Gulf War, first Gulf War of 1991. The question is it a success? Well, suppose we drive them out of Kuwait. That's what the idea of what you're supposed to do. If no Americans die, 80% of the people would consider it a success. This is asked before the war. If 500 Americans die, the percentage of people saying it was a success drops to 50. If you double that to 1,000, it drops to 37% and so forth. So what you get is basically a fairly big drop off at the beginning as relatively lukewarm supporters drop off, and then you're down to the harder core supporters, people for whom casualties are, they're willing to pay casualties. This is a question about Bosnia, an issue of far less importance. Americans paid almost no attention to Bosnia most of the time in the 1990s, despite all the elite cues that were coming out of Washington and out of New York Times and so forth. And when they're asked about sending troops, they're perfectly willing to send troops as long as nobody got killed. However, if 25 Americans were killed, the support dropped from 67% down to 31%. So what you get basically is a evaluation of how important is the Balkans? Is it the heart of Europe or is it the armpit of Europe? How much does it matter to the United States? And how much are we willing to pay for it? So if Japan is attacking Pearl Harbor, that's a big deal, willing to spend lots of casualties. If 9/11 has a similar type of effect. If it's a humanitarian venture, they're willing to pay much less. This is a similar question before the Gulf War, the current war, a similar sort of thing. Basically, 35% of the people were against the war. 58% would favor the war if there were no casualties, but the percentage of people willing to support the war dropped to 37%, or 46% if any were killed, and as you can see, a gradual progression down. Interestingly, we now are about 4,000 fatalities, and using more or less the same question, 33% of the people still favor the war, and as you can see, that's basically where it was for this question was asked before the war even took place. Sort of magical. So that's the concern about American casualties is very high. concern about foreign casualties is not very high. This is a question asked before World War II, after the Japanese surrender. And the question after the Japanese surrender was, what should we have done with the bombing of Hiroshima? As you can see, 23% of the population was said we should have quickly dropped many more atomic bombs on Japan before it had a chance to surrender. This is not warm and cuddly. And that's probably an extreme case of hatred of the enemy. However, in Iraq, there was a question asked, do you think the people of Iraq should share the blame for Saddam Hussein's policies, this is before the 1991 war, or are they innocent of any blame for his policies? And what you had is about 60% of the people saying they're innocent of any blame. I mean, just that's probably the least hatred toward an enemy population ever. Nonetheless, when people were asked about bombing of Iraqis, you can see the people percent wanting to increase or decrease the amount of bombing. Then there was a bombing in which a Baghdad shelter was killing a lot of Iraqis during the 1991 war. And then the question is asked again, virtually no change. My favorite example is this. Leslie Stahl asked Madeleine Albright in the middle of 1995, in the middle of the 1990s, we've heard that 500,000 children have died because of the sanctions in Iraq. I mean, that's more children than died at Hiroshima. And, you know, is the price worth it? Madeleine Albright basically said, sure, what the hell. Now, I looked that up in LexisNexis. We have basically a major official of the United States government saying we've killed 500,000 children, which is probably an exaggeration, but nonetheless. She says, yeah, what the hell? It's only 500,000 children under the age of five. And nobody picked it up. I couldn't find any place in the whole United States in which 60 Minutes yet this was even considered. She was later made Secretary of State. And if this is not new, this is from Vietnam. This question asks people to pick, they give them a card, and there are two, and they ask them, it's not just one reason we're in Vietnam, but two or three reasons, so you can pick several. And what you can see is the concern about the Vietnamese people was microscopic. These are all about the Cold War, and the percentage of people on this card who picked this one, if we pull out the communists, might kill a lot of South Vietnamese, only got 14% support. Even though you could pick that as well as, you know, things about the American troops. Next point. The president does not necessarily need public support in advance to pull off a military venture. Essentially, what he can do is basically do it. And then what happens is, even people don't think it's a very good idea necessarily, if it's a success in the sense that the costs are commensurate with the gain, then they'll basically buy it. In some cases, the troops have been sent where the public was obviously very supportive after Pearl Harbor, et cetera. At some times, they've been sent where it's very divided. And then what happens is you're in a situation in which you have to make the war work given the constraints of cost tolerance. And sometimes you do and sometimes you don't. There's also, if you're a president, there's probably not much gain from successful military ventures. The most spectacular case on this was George Bush first. One of the biggest successes, certainly in foreign policy from the standpoint of public opinion, was the first Gulf War. And as you can see, where the Gulf War ended, he was spectacularly high in terms of approval. And that basically traced his ratings for foreign policy, which are the red dots. However, what's really interesting is that at the end of the war, his ratings for how he's doing on the economy went up. In fact, at the end of the war, all his ratings went up. Not only how he's handling foreign policy, how he's dealing with the war, but also how he's dealing with the homeless, how he's keeping taxes down, even a question about how's he doing at keeping us out of war. People said he's great. but what you can see, within days, his rating for the domestic issues would drop back to where it was before. And that, of course, was ultimately to condemn him in the election the next year because he didn't get the point. Some people argue that the public is defeat phobic, but it seems to me the United States people are very capable of accepting defeat. Ronald Reagan, for example, in 1982 came out with one of these fatuous comments that are so common among presidents. In the age of thermonuclear challenge, conflicts are a threat to all the people of the world, not just to the Middle East. If we don't send troops into Lebanon, the world is going to come to an end. Then what happened was The troops went in. 280 of them were killed by a terrorist bomb. After a certain amount of pressure, Reagan withdrew them. And the attitude afterward, it was a total defeat, essentially. And the attitude afterwards was, well, actually quite grown up. It was a failure. But most people said, well, it didn't work. I mean, that's what grown-ups do, right? So basically, they accepted it. And Reagan then ran for re-election in 1984, and the issue scarcely came up. The same thing with Somalia under Clinton, that after the few Americans were killed, we got this basic situation, that how long should we keep the troops in there? There's a lot of people, as you can see, to make sure we get all our prisoners back. That was a big deal, American prisoners. And then get the hell out. And that's basically what he did. That was 1993, 1996 election, didn't even come up. And this kind of attitude, nothing in the United States could accomplish in Somalia is worth the death of even one soldier. Also related to this, somewhat digressing a tiny bit, is about the Haiti coup, another case of fatuous twaddle. After there was a coup in Haiti in the early 90s, George Bush the First said it was an unusual, extraordinary threat to national security, foreign policy, and the economy of the United States. We now know why the stock market has been tanking. It's because of Haiti. Then when Clinton actually sent in troops a few years later, he stated the same thing. He quoted George Bush. At any rate, the opinion on Haiti was the same sort of thing. How many American soldiers is it worth to bring peace or stability or whatever the hell it is to Haiti? The answer is none. Very close to that. The spectacular case of this, a failure, however, was Vietnam. Vietnam was a nightmare. In 1975, it went down in total disarray from an American foreign policy standpoint. Gerald Ford appears in his last debate, and he takes credit for the debacle. This is 1 year after the debacle, and he says, when I came into office, we were still involved there, now we're out, vote for me. In other words, the Americans, by 1 year later, after the debacle, basically people were, you know, not even talking about it, not even thinking about it, and it was not influencing them. This will be good news for John McCain. If they're not being killed, Americans can remain in peacekeeping ventures virtually indefinitely. No one gives a damn particularly about where American soldiers are if they're not being killed. That may be relevant now to the Iraq things right now. Basically, even if you're opposed to the war, if it gets to the point where no Americans are being killed, one thing that happens is no one pays much attention to it anymore, which is happening. And the other is, so what? I mean, the troops can be there or not there. If they're not being killed, who cares whether they're in Iraq or at Fort Leavenworth? So even after a situation in which there's been a lot of casualties, that may be the case. Okay, let me do a few comparisons of the Iraq War. This is the run-up to the Iraq War, or the current one. As you can see, despite the bully pulpit or whatever, George Bush was not able really to increase support for going to war. There was a big support increase all by itself with 9/11, with nobody saying much of anything. That dissipated, and during the run-up to the war in 2002, we got a situation in which there was various ups and downs and so forth, but mostly it just stayed very much in the same range. Maybe they were able to arrest decline, but they certainly weren't able to increase support for going to war on this question or many others. And similarly, the first Gulf War is this. When George Bush the First tried to win support for going to war, he was not able basically to increase support for going to war at all. Once the war starts, you get a rally around the flag effect, and that's different. Let me make one comment, which I'm actually going to make later, and I'll just skip it for later and do it now because it relates to both the previous presentations. There's a really interesting development between these two wars. You can't compare the Gulf War and the current Iraq War because they're obviously very different, but the run-ups were very similar. A Republican president wanting to go to war and the Democrats being against it. Now, what happened was, according to Gary Jacobson's data, was that Democrats should have been getting, the partisan gap should have been bigger for the earlier war, because the Democrats were totally opposed, substantially opposed to it in Congress, and the Republicans were in favor of it. In the later war, the Democrats more or less took a dive by comparison. Nonetheless, the partisan gap between the first war and the second is the reverse. The partisan gap is much bigger for the second war, where there are far fewer Democratic cues on that. Okay, let me Also, these numbers up here are questionable. Actually, that moved a little bit. Okay, anyway. Okay. One thing that does happen in run-up to war is you can increase the likelihood war is going to take place. That's the main thing that happened. In terms of the decline of a support for the war, it basically follows a pattern I sort of indicated earlier, decline earlier on and a sort of leveling out. What you do is you find sort of ups and downs with good events and bad events, but a gradual erosion, and you're down to the more tough supporters. Since the surge has taken place, there's been an increase, as we've already heard, in people thinking good things about the war. It's making things better. It's having no impact. It's gone down. This is over the last year. The U.S. is making significant progress. Has gone up. And the United States is winning the war. However, it hasn't changed the support for the war. The favor of the war has changed. It's stayed the same. The war has been worth it. It's stayed the same. The war is going in the right direction. Has, if anything, gone down. Should we stay as long as it takes? Same numbers. And approve Bush's handling has surged from 33 to 34. Meanwhile, by the way, the percentage of people thinking Saddam Hussein did 9/11 is down to only 28%, which is more or less the popularity rating of George Bush. This is the Korean War. I have to go through this because I'm being pressured on time here. Vietnam, if you put them all together, and this is Afghanistan, if you put them all together, basically what you get is this. A fair amount of similarity between decline of support using exactly the same question for Iraq, Afghanistan, I mean, Iraq, Vietnam, and Korea. A big difference, however, though, is when you get to about the 50% level of support, casualties in Vietnam and Korea had been about 20,000 dead. When you get to 50 percentage points support in Iraq, they've been about 2,000. My thinking is, therefore, that Korea and Vietnam are far more highly valued. Very interesting is Afghanistan at the top, obviously off the charts, maybe declining now. These later numbers have just come out in the last few weeks. The wars, of course, are very punishing to presidents. Truman was wiped out. Johnson was wiped out. Bush would have done much better in 2004 without the war. Tony Blair, the most effective politician in British history, perhaps, was destroyed by the war. In other words, if the war goes on too long and it gets down too far, your electoral prospects are in problem. Okay, we haven't talked about the war on terror, and let me give you a few very quick things on that, the stuff I'm working on now. I think it's been massively overblown, hence the title of my book. But what's happening is the concerns about the war on terror, about terrorism, have stayed pretty much the same. There may have been somewhat of concern dropped in the last year, but attention to the issue has declined. And it seems to me this is mostly bottom-up. People were traumatized by 9/11, and so what we have is a creation of a terrorism industry, which exacerbates the fear because it's good for them. It also leads to the idea that there's an existential threat. Bush has been the big cheerleader, but the Democrats and everybody else has done it as well. This is George Bush's speech to the Congress in 2003, in which he's going to ask for $80-plus billion for the war in Iraq. I downloaded the whole speech and took out all the irrelevant words, and you're down to this. Okay, also what happens is that there's been the consequence of this, I think, is that the war on terror has become a self-licking ice cream cone, as the Washington phrase has it. That essentially what's happening is that it'll go on forever, no matter what, even if people don't pay attention. It'd be like the war on drugs. I mean, who talks about that? Will it ever stop? No. And the same with going against domestic communists during the Cold War. At one time, there's a lot of concern about it. By the 60s, 70s, 80s, there wasn't. Nonetheless, the FBI was still in there trying to find them. In terms of the threat out there, Al-Qaeda is the only group that threatens to attack the United States. The total amount of damage they or people like them have been able to do since 9/11 comes to maybe 200 or 300 terrorism deaths a year. That's 200 or 300 too many, but not outside of war zones, not too many. The Transportation Security Administration kills 400 a year because short-haul airplanes are much more likely. Short-haul airplane traffic has gone down, and so they're driving, and that's more dangerous. The effect of al-Qaeda terrorism has mostly been counterproductive, turning people against them in Indonesia, Syria, Jordan, Egypt, etc. There's nobody, they have not been able to find a single al-Qaeda cell or person really in the United States, and it's an extremely tiny group, maybe it consists of 150 people. Their chance of getting nuclear weapons, I think, are also vanishingly small. So let me end on that cheerful note. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to start while this is trying to be loaded up. I have much too much material to present in 3 minutes, so I won't try. I just wanted to say that these were all terrific papers. I got to read the whole papers. This is really high-level, first-rate social science on all counts, and you would do well to try to get a hold of them and read them, either the books that are coming out or the papers themselves. I think the question that they all at least partially address is what shapes popular support for wars? And the basic question is it reality or is it elite rhetoric, elite leadership? Is it reality or is it framing by elites? And basically, I think John Mueller's position is it's reality. The public responds to costs and benefits, the costs usually in form of casualties, the benefits in terms of the expectations about whether the stakes are great or small in the conflict, that over time, as the costs increase in terms of casualties, then the support for the war goes down. It goes down not linearly, but logarithmically, but monotonically. It doesn't go back up at the end. For Adam Berinsky, he argues, I think, basically that it's elite cues are the primal cause. It's not reality, and it's how elites portray reality, react to reality, and respond to that. Public responds to elites according to whether they're united or divided along the lines of the either partisan or ideological identifications of the people involved. For Matt Baum and Tim Grueling, they say it's both. It's at the beginning, it's elites. It's beginning, it's framing. It's the media, and then reality takes over as it hits. So there's a kind of thesis, antithesis, synthesis going on here with the Baum and Grueling doing the synthesis. Okay. I prepared a bunch of slides. I'm going to whip through them. This is just the overall support for the war over time. Partisan differences, you've seen this one before. It hasn't changed. I'm just showing you what the data look like. And now here's what I want to kind of focus on briefly, is the very tight connection between opinions on the war and opinions on Bush during the course of this war. Over time, they've paralleled each other. They're consistent, where people either supporting the war and approving of Bush or opposing the war, disapproving of Bush 83% of the time. That's much higher than it was for Truman in Korea. It's much higher than it was for Johnson in Vietnam. They were in the 60s. This is in the 80s. And it's true of all partisan categories. Democrats' approval of Bush and the war paralleled themselves, 83% consistent. I think this has to stand as kind of evidence against the argument that Adam was making, that Democrats, even though their leaders weren't opposed to the war, weren't actively opposing the war, that they negatively cued on Bush. Because you'd have to say that, well, as their opinion of Bush went down, then their opinion of the war went down, decreased. And I think the causal direction is just the opposite. That is, as their opinion of the war went down, and it went down for reasons that I think are consistent with John's argument, that is, Democrats initially supported the war because they accepted the premise that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, that Saddam Hussein maybe was involved in 9/11, and that after the war, Iraq would become a successful democracy. It wouldn't be a costly enterprise. As they were disillusioned about all of those things, their support for the war went down, and therefore their support for Bush went down. So I think that's an argument for the reality effect for Democrats. For Republicans, reality didn't seem to have any effect, or a very little effect. That is, disappointments about the war did not affect Republicans very strongly. And I think my explanation for that is that they had such a strong prior commitment to Bush that they were perfectly willing to accept almost anything he said about the war, including after weapons of mass destruction couldn't be found, et cetera, that the new justification, this was a central front for the war on terrorism, that they were perfectly willing to accept that. So the way I interpret the data are that Republicans continued to support the war because they supported Bush. The Democrats' support for Bush disappeared because the war disillusioned them. That is, their views of the war caused their views of Bush rather than vice versa. For Republicans, it was just the opposite. For independents, it was more like Democrats than it was like Republicans. Some evidence for this question, did Iraq possess weapons of mass destruction? This goes up to January 2008. A majority of Republicans still believe, or say they believe, that there are weapons of mass destruction. I don't think they care one way or another whether there were weapons of mass destruction, but they support the war, they support Bush, and therefore they're willing to say, yes, there were. Democrats got disillusioned about this early and gave up on that. Similar patterns, but not nearly so stark, on was Saddam Hussein involved in 9/11. Again, you still have a substantial proportion of the public thinking that he was. Very strong priors, negative priors on him. Again, this is Republicans accepting the fallback justification for the war, that it's the central front of the war on terrorism. They've accepted that from the beginning and haven't changed on that at all. So you have these two different processes going on here. For Democrats, as they stop believing that that there were weapons of mass destruction, that Saddam Hussein was involved in 9/11, that the war was central to the war on terrorism, their support for the war went down, but they also turned very negative on Bush. This is the question, do you believe the administration intentionally misled the public? And for the last couple of years, about 80% of the Democrats have said yes, they were conned into the war. Republicans don't believe that. And again, independents closer to Democrats than to Republicans on these things. Is George Bush honest and trustworthy? Their estimates of his character declined dramatically. Again, huge partisan differences generated by this. I wanted to just throw this up here for John Mueller's sake. This is sort of modeling his model of casualties and support for the war. In his analysis in his original book, as casualty, the log of cumulative casualties, the coefficient on that was about -0.15. For this war, it's much steeper. It's about -2. That is, every time casualties, cumulative casualties go up by a factor of 10, war support drops 21 points. 15 points in the Vietnam War, about 15 points in the Korean War, about 20 points in this war, but with very different trajectories for Republicans, Democrats, and independents. And another thing in favor of John's analysis is that I ran these equations 18 months ago and predicted where war support would be now based on those equations, given casualties, expected casualties at this time. And it turns out that you predict overall within 1 point of where we are now, for Democrats within about 2 points, for independents about 1 point. Republicans are about 4 points lower than I would have predicted in the earlier model. But the model predicted current support for the war very, very well. Now, as regard to the surge, this is just underlining something that John said, how people have reacted to the increasing positive information coming out of Iraq, that things aren't as bad as they were 2 years ago. Is the surge helping? Again, this orange line, better in helping, has gone up. The proportion thing is making us no difference. The green line has gone down. There's a sense that the surge is working. It's across all parties, a big partisan gap. But Republicans, Democrats, and independents all think that the surge is are tending toward more positive views of the surge. How well is the war going? Again, there's been a movement in the positive direction and is visible in among both Republicans and Democrats. Who's winning the war? Again, back in December 2006, people were equally likely to say that insurgents were winning, that U.S. were winning, although most people said we didn't know yet, it was undetermined. But sense of U.S. doing better than the insurgents certainly has gone up since then. Optimism about the war, is the U.S. winning? We're making significant progress. That's up. Nonetheless, support for the war itself hasn't gone up at all, or gone up a minuscule amount, if at all. That is, even though there's more optimism about the direction of the war, these questions about whether it was a good idea or not, whether it was a mistake, was it the right thing, et cetera, there's no increase in support on that ground. Whatever increase there is, it takes place, if there's any, it's a little bit among Republicans, a little bit among Democrats. What the surge seemed to have done is to stem the losses among Republicans more than anything else. Do we want a timetable? Do we want to set a timetable? Again, there's been no change in the preference for setting some kind of timetable to get out since the surge. There's the partisan differences on timetables show a clear sign of kind of elite responding to elites. So at that point in April 07, where suddenly the Republicans stop supporting timetables at a high level. Their support for timetables goes down, Democrats goes up. That's when this was argued between Congress and the president. But after that, we kind of they sort of resumed in the same position that they were before. Support for keeping the U.S. troops in Iraq. The red dots are the ones where you say keep them rather than leave tomorrow. That is immediate support for staying rather than immediately leaving. The blue dots are support for staying rather than leaving sometime. Planning to leave, starting to withdraw. Again, the downward trends in both of them have been the same, and they have not been interrupted by anything that's gone on in Iraq. Partisan differences, again, have maintained. Partisans have pretty much maintained the same position that they've had for quite some time on this. So my conclusion is not really much of a conclusion, that these papers all address these questions, that indeed reality seems to matter, but it matters differently for different folks to a different degree, that prior views, in this case, in this war, partisan views are incredibly powerful in shaping people's responses to everything. All perceptions about the war, both how things are going, how it's being evaluated, and that over time support for the war has eroded, support for the president has eroded together, and that erosion, at least so far, has been impermeable or almost impermeable to any improvement on the ground there. So I'll leave with that.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.